the exact same injury. There's options out there. There's hope.
Hey, it's your friend Mel, and welcome to the Mel Robbins Podcast. Please help me welcome the extraordinary Dr. Sanjay Gupta to the Mel Robbins Podcast.
I've been really looking forward to this, Mel. I'm a huge fan of yours, a huge fan of the show, and honored that you'd have me. Thank you.
Of course. And I am excited to see you after we were colleagues and friends at CNN. I am proud of the work that you're doing. I'm so excited for your new New York Times bestselling book, It Doesn't Have to Hurt. We're going to talk all things about living a pain-free life based on the research and the science. And I'd love to start by having you tell me, what could be different about my life if I take into account everything that you're about to teach us today?
Most people are going to have pain at some point in their lives. But this idea that it has to become chronic pain, that it has to last, that is where the intervention can occur. And I think we haven't spent much time talking about this. People develop acute pain, and for some reason, it persists. It's like this memory loop just keeps getting played over and over in their brains. And I think we've learned a lot over the last decade about how to prevent that from happening. So not letting acute pain, which most people are going to experience, turn into chronic pain. If I had to add a more to the title of the book, you always want longer titles, I would say it doesn't have to hurt as much or as long.
Oh, I love that. What is the difference between acute pain and chronic pain? Just for somebody like me who's not a medical doctor?
Yeah. So acute pain is pain that you might feel in the moment. You know, touch hot pan, hot, move your hand away.
Okay.
Stub toe. Chronic pain is when it just lasts. So there's no ongoing insult or injury to your body, and yet the pain persists. People, they try and put a time frame on it. So they say if you have pain like that every day for 3 months, at that point, it's considered chronic pain.
Okay.
If you have it sort of every other day for 6 months, you know, you sort of get the idea, but it's pain that just simply won't go away.
Dr. Gupta, could you give us a quick list of just things that might be considered chronic pain?
I think if you go literally from head to toe, I think headaches, such as migraine headaches, that'd be considered a type of chronic pain. That's a big percentage. Going into the face, there are people who have facial pain, like trigeminal neuralgia and TMJ. Most joints can be a source of chronic pain, going from your shoulders, your elbows, your hips, your knees, down to your ankles.
Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the summary of your favorites podcasts. Delve into the surprising link between sleep and pain relief. Discover how societal attitudes and medical practices may have led us astray, and explore a more hopeful approach to addressing pain at its roots.
Reduce your pain scores.
Simply by addressing sleep.
Sleep. That's the thing. And this is measurable. I think that people have sort of anecdotally known this for some time. But, you know, understandably, we're a society that wants data and evidence and facts and proof of that. We treat symptoms far more than we treat root causes. And I think pain is probably the best example of that in society. At one point, we are what? Not even 5% of the world's population, and we are taking 90% of the world's pain meds.
Wait, say that again?
We are not even 5% of the world's population, and we were taking 90% of the world's pain medication. So
what does that tell you?
Tells me we don't like pain. We have deep disdain for pain in this country. And look, I don't like pain either. But the idea that you can overly medicalize something, that you can overly proceduralize something. We did 1.2 million spinal operations last year, okay? To give you context, in the UK, they did about 50,000. Now, they're a quarter of our population, but still, you do the math. If they were doing our rate, it would, you know, still be 1/6 of what we do here in this country. So we don't like pain, and we'll do anything to rid ourselves of pain. But most of the things that we do not necessarily treat the root cause. There's even cultural things when it comes to pain. I mean, this book that I wrote is not about the opioid epidemic, although you can't talk about pain in this country without talking about it. Like, how did that happen? How did we get to the point where 80 to 90% of opioids were being used in the United States alone, worldwide, you know, consumption? To be honest, I think part of that was because pain sort of became considered what they call the fifth vital sign. So, you know, it's as important as respirations and heart rate and all these other things when you go into the emergency room. People would be asked about their pain. Mm. They came in for a cold, you know? So pain just became something that everyone was super focused on. And I think it led to a lot of treatment when treatment wasn't always necessary. Because I don't want that to come off non-empathetic. Like, right. I'm really, really empathetic to people's pain. But at the same time, can we say we've overtreated it? We've overoperated on it. And we even do things culturally that don't happen in other places around the world. The data suggests very much that's the case.
Well, I don't think that's the case you're making at all in your book. I think the case that you're making is one that's extraordinarily exciting and optimistic, because you're basically saying that you may have lived a long time with this. You may have been over-medicated.
Next, a fascinating exploration unfolds as experts reveal innovative pain management techniques that challenge traditional opioid use. From virtual reality to nerve blocks, discover how these methods reshape emergency care and enhance recovery.
One is, you know, high-tech, innovative work that is happening, which as a neuroscientist was really mind-blowing for me. And I've been in this world for 25 years, so I learned a lot. But I think the second thing is, because opioids sort of sucked up all the oxygen in the room for 25 years. You got opioids for everything. Kidney stone, dental procedure, hip fracture, everything was treated with an opioid. As a result, all these other modalities, some of which are not new, some of which are quite old actually, got short shrift. They just were not utilized for things.
What are some of those modalities?
If somebody comes into the emergency room with a hip fracture, which is a really common problem, especially as people get older, they almost assuredly would get opioids. Now, in many ERs around the country, they're giving nerve blocks. So it takes about 10 minutes, and they're essentially numbing up the area around the hip and giving this nerve block. Helps with pain immediately. Pain scores drop to zero. But also, it obviates the need or prevents the need for opioids going into the future. They don't need opioids after that. They've gotten rid of that acute pain syndrome. When I was in this emergency room in Brooklyn, Maimonides, which is this really cool place, by the way, it's level one trauma center, super diverse. They speak 120 languages there. And they are championing what they refer to as opioid-optimized ERs, which is not to say opioid-free, because opioids can still play a role, but they will use opioids as a last resort instead of a first resort. But they were using virtual reality.
How does that help with pain?
There was a 76-year-old woman who came in with terrible knee pain, bad enough to take her to an emergency room in the middle of the day, which, you know, that's a big ask of somebody, right? It's your whole day. And they put on virtual reality goggles, 20 minutes, took her to a nice Indonesian beach somewhere, and her pain scores dropped from about an 8 to a 3. How does it work?
What's your theory?
People always often say it's distraction. I think it's probably some component of distraction from the pain. But I think it's also leaning into this idea that we do truly have this integrated system. If you are on an Indonesian beach, your stress levels are probably dropping. You're probably releasing more of the feel-good hormones. You're activating something in your body known as your endogenous opioid system.
What is that?
It is our body making opioids. You know, the opioid pills that you take, like many things in medicine, got their inspiration from the human body. So many of the things that we do in medicine take our inspiration from the human body. But let me tell you the big difference between the opioids you make versus the opioids you take. Opioids you take, like pills and stuff like that, they may decrease pain, but they may also enhance memory. Okay, so they actually, in some ways, are forcing you to remember that experience or remember that pain, sort of creating that memory loop around pain. And they also decrease mood.
Prepare to uncover the surprising power of the mind as it relates to pain. This segment explores the fascinating interplay between neuroplasticity and pain perception, revealing how understanding it can open doors to healing.
Because, you know, when I've been in pain, I want to defend it. Because it feels very real. But if you could just open your mind to the possibility that maybe you don't need to fix your back or your leg or your neck, maybe that part of the solution is really addressing the memory loop that's playing in your head, that opens up a whole different possibility and an avenue of treatment and pain relief that you haven't even considered. In fact, you write, I want to read to you from your blockbuster book, It Doesn't Have to Hurt. This comes from page number 9. The point is that the brain creates pain on cue from a vast array of stimuli, biology, psychology, social, emotional, environmental, even cultural. And just as we now understand that the brain can be nurtured, developed, and optimized at any age, there's growing evidence that the brain can also rewire itself in ways that change the neural circuitry for pain?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Reducing its intensity or duration and potentially eliminating it altogether. So you're saying that there's growing evidence that your brain can rewire itself and change that memory loop and the neural circuitry for pain, even pain that happened a long time ago that you're still remembering.
Still dealing with, still remembering. Neuroplasticity, you know, which is sort of the name for this larger concept of being able to change your brain. There's this phrase, I think it came from like the 1940s, Hebbian, Hebb was the doctor who coined this, but basically neurons that fire together, wire together. The thing about neuroplasticity that I think a lot of people don't realize is that it's not an inherently benevolent process, nor is it malevolent, nor is it bad. It's neutral. It'll kind of do whatever you ask it to do. So if you're hyper-focused on the pain, you're firing neurons together and they're going to wire together and that's going to reinforce the memory loop. What is, I think, fascinating about pain is that pain circuits travel and they go through all these various areas. Your amygdala, which is your emotional center, it tends to be larger in patients who are in chronic pain. Their prefrontal cortex tends to be smaller. So their judgment and things like that tend to not be as good because their prefrontal cortex is shrunk to some extent. But it also goes through the hippocampus, which is your memory store. So you might start to really remember it well. Your past experiences with pain, you remember those and they may amplify your current episode with pain. So every time you start to have a twinge of pain, it's like, man, it just like skyrockets. It's like it just went from 0 to 100 just like that. And I've seen this in patients, even like in real time. They'll be in my office, Mel, and they'll you know, sort of be there. And then all of a sudden they're cringy.
Coming up, a deep dive into the complexities of pain perception unfolds. Listeners will discover how past experiences and emotional baggage may intensify discomfort and complicate the healing journey.
Does it work the same way, or how is that different, or is it different at all?
I think it's different because when you have a structural problem, whether it be in your spine or a joint, you're continuously activating those pain receptors.
Okay.
And so that is a little different than somebody who basically, you look at them and you got, there's nothing going on here. Structurally, anatomically, otherwise, there's no injury, whatever it might be. So then it's, then you have to focus more on what other parts of this pain system are not working properly. And that's all going to be in the brain. So, you know, like Rich Roll, I talked to him the other day. He had a very significant spine problem.
Oh my gosh. And he did surgery where they went in the front and the back.
The back. Yes. Yes. Rich is a good friend. We were talking throughout that entire process and, you know, he's a Ultraman athlete, you know, just, I think he was shocked at how much his post-op recovery sort of took. Now, one thing that Rich would say if he were here was that he'd been dealing with chronic pain really for 13 years, since 2012. And part of the reason that it took a lot longer for him to heal, and he's still not completely recovered from a pain standpoint, his pain, which was acute back in 2012, started to basically be encompassed by all this baggage that we talk about. And Rich, as smart as he is and as resilient as he is, probably wasn't addressing the baggage that came with this. That idea of even a guy like him, so this should, you know, he's an Ultraman, he's an athlete, he takes great care of himself, yet he still had this because of that added baggage. I think now that he's addressing that more, I think in a very, very intentional way, he's starting to get relief from his pain.
I would love to have you just tick off before we jump into the protocol that people can follow. What constitute baggage that creates a greater pain sensation and goes along with it so that as you're listening on behalf of yourself or a loved one, and you may have a structural issue, you may need surgery for something, you may need physical therapy, but there's probably some things that are weighing you down that both increase pain and also help alleviate it and help accelerate your healing. So what is like the top five things of baggage that you tend to see?
Previous history of pain.
Okay.
Is a big one. If you've had pain in the past, then you have a relationship with pain. And for many people, that amplifies a future pain experience. Depression. About 40% of people with chronic pain also have depression. Anxiety. Mostly untreated forms of this, but even in people who have some forms of treatment, they may still have added chronic pain. Poor sleep. That was a big one. And again, it's a bi-directional sort of relationship. Mm-hmm. Pain worsens sleep, sleep worsens pain. But those are some of the big things, I think, that have always felt a little squishy in terms of the relationship to pain.
Next, listeners will uncover the surprising connections between chronic pain and everyday habits like sleep and stress management. Join them as they explore how addressing mental well-being can significantly alleviate physical discomfort.
There's not something that's continuously activating those pain receptors. Then think about movement. Think about exercise even.
I have TMJ, but I didn't even consider that chronic pain. Right. It bothered me so much, I actually got surgery on the joint 20 years ago. But as I'm sitting
did
here—
Did that help?
Oh, it helped a lot. But so did the fact that I wear the bike guard. But I'm also hearing you talk, and I'm like, well, actually, the more I've prioritized sleep, and the more that I'm moving my body, and the more that I manage my stress, funny thing, I'm not grinding my jaw into the ground as much anymore, and it's not as painful. So, I mean, it used to lock, Sanjay.
Really?
And you know, I'm about to turn you into our personal team doctor here and ask you a bunch of questions.
Okay.
But, you know, the NIH says more than 10 million people in the U.S. live with jaw pain.
I think when you look at temporal mandibular joint, so this joint in here—
Is that what TMJ is?
TMJ, exactly. Temporomandibular
joint. That's a mouthful.
Literally. Yeah. You know, for a lot of people, there's different reasons for it. But one thing I would say is the numbers have gone up pretty significantly over the last couple of decades. Why would that be? We're not eating different foods necessarily. Like, why would our jaws be hurting a lot more? And I think it's, you know, goes back to many of the same things that are driving a lot of disease in our country. Again, you think of heart disease, you think I'm eating too much meat. Yeah, maybe to some extent, but there's also the stress that you live in. People who are socially isolated have more heart disease. Hmm. What's the relationship there? Even if they're healthy eaters, we find that isolation triggers pain centers in the brain. My point being that there's lots of things that could be sort of driving the TMJ, and many of the ills of our society are the same things that are driving chronic disease, drive chronic pain. So, you know, getting to the root cause, you clearly had some root causes with regard to the amount of stress and everything else in your life. I don't know if you saw someone who's a specialist to deal with that part of your life. Maybe you did, but if you did, the idea that you're doing it because you want to fix your jaw, right? I want to fix my pain. So I'm seeing a psychologist.
I love this paradigm shift that you would go work on your mindset.
Yeah.
And work on your stress levels.
Yes.
And work on your resilience.
Yep.
And that would cure your jaw pain.
Yeah. Or greatly mitigate it.
Prepare to dive into a heartfelt discussion on overcoming chronic pain as the speakers share their personal journeys and transformative methods that have not only inspired hope, but also sparked remarkable healing.
But the story, which is very daunting, and so many people can relate to it, also proves that over time, all of these changes that you're talking about, that really galvanize the natural intelligence and desire of your body to heal and to be pain-free, they can work. And that is an incredible gift that you're giving to all of us. And so thank you to Rebecca. Thank you to your mom. Thank you to you.
Well, I really appreciate that, Mel, especially coming from you. It's, you know, you write books, as you well know, and you know, you spent 3 years. I spent 3 years working on the book, and I was dreaming about it at some points. You know, just it takes over your life, and I wanted to learn everything I could. And had I written the book that I really wanted to write, it probably would have been, you know, this thick.
We wouldn't have read it.
You
so
wouldn't
I'm
have
glad
read
it's smaller. No, just kidding.
But on the other hand, I wanted to put things in the book that you can't just easily go and Google.
Yes.
I wanted to give you the why behind the what, because I felt like if you understood why these things worked, and you could actually see the data and maybe even meet some of the researchers who many of them have pain themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what inspired them to do this kind of work and understand their stories and then understand how they set up an experiment and how they validated the experiment and then what it means for you. It's powerful stuff. It's powerful for me. You know, I incorporate these things into my own life as well. My wife gets tremendous relief from meditation now, and she is the biggest skeptic of all. I'm skeptical.
Well, she's a lawyer, a former
lawyer.
Right?
Like, so show me the data on this. I'm not, you know, there will be faith to abandon if this doesn't work for me, you know? So, but I did it with her. And my mom, who is an engineer, you know, so very science-minded, first woman ever hired as an engineer at the Ford Motor Company
cool.
back in the 60s. So, you know, just that sort of persona. I did meditation with her as well. And it's not just meditation. It's all these other things. It's the movement. You know, my wife's pain got so bad at times that when I would get home from work, I'd have to carry her up the stairs. She just couldn't go up the stairs on her own. Everything just hurt too much. Just grimacing every single movement. And there's all these different things that we tried. It wasn't just meditation. But I think what was striking to me as we traveled to all these hospitals around the country trying to get her care was that everyone's like, all right, let's try a TNF blocker. Let's try this particular pain medication. Let's try this autoimmune therapy. How about Humira? Have you done that? Which we greatly appreciated all that. She was still in pain though. So, you know, it was the baggage that was not getting addressed. And I felt helpless at times to try and help her. But the idea that ultimately, you know, I started meditating myself, doing these other things myself, really focusing on movement, I think really helped her. She ended up doing the Malibu triathlon with me. So it's...
Well, from being carried up the stairs to doing a triathlon using these approaches?
It works. It works.
What do you do if the person that you love is experiencing chronic pain and they just feel so discouraged?
It's really hard, Mel. You're talking about 50 million people right now, at least. These are the people who actually come forward and raise their hand and say, I'm in chronic pain. Mm. A lot of people still don't because there's so much stigma attached to it. I think what I say to people is that there's an off-ramp.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it. Thank you.